Hi, and thanks for tuning in to this first episode of Premeditated, a true crime podcast. I really hope you guys enjoy it. This is a side project of mine right now, hoping that it turns into a bigger project that kind of takes over my life. And with you guys' support, hopefully that will become a reality. Thanks, and I hope you guys enjoy the show. "We called him the thrill killer," said Jason January, one of the Dallas County District Attorney prosecutors responsible for his conviction. It definitely fit. He was truly a living, breathing, killing machine, and the world's going to be safer once he's gone. He was one of the few people I dealt with in 15 years with the DA's office that clearly demonstrated he enjoyed killing. Juan Rodriguez Chavez, also known as the thrill killer, was a child in a family of 19. His parents, a migrant farm worker couple, moved to Dallas not long after they had him. Juan was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana, April 27, 1968. He attended the ninth grade, but ended up dropping out of school at the age of 17. Just a few years later, he was convicted of murder for fatally shooting a neighbor and wounding another man during a 1985 burglary. The victim of that crime was named Vicente Mendoza, and he was killed in Dallas County on December 28, 1985, fatally shot by Juan in that home burglary gone wrong. Or maybe to Juan it had gone right. You see, Juan Chavez was charged with murder with a deadly weapon, and he was given a 15-year sentence. To me, even now, that seems like a lenient sentence for a judge to be handing down on a deadly weapon murder charge. But that's what he got, and that's what he was given. Now, the crazy thing was, he was a 19-year-old at the time, and by the time he was released, I mean, he was like 26 years old. Because not a lot is known about his time served in prison, except for the fact that he had over 40 violations of prison protocol. I mean, some of these incidents included punching a corrections officer, and this one's particularly crazy to me. He scaled two separate barbed wire fences in order to get to another inmate who was in a recreation area so that he could attack him. I mean, that is pretty determined, if you ask me. So Chavez had his meeting with the parole board, and he was paroled after 7 years served of a 15-year sentence in March 1994. Mainly because of the strict prison population caps are imposed by U.S. District Judge William Wayne Justice. I just couldn't believe this. You're letting somebody who's a convicted murderer out on supervised parole after 7 years served. I mean, I get it. I get that, you know, jails and prisons and whatnot get overpopulated and you need to make room for new prisoners, I guess, if you're convicting that many people of whatever crimes they're convicted of. But this just seemed like it was a bad call. I mean, it was already a short sentence to begin with. Just let him serve it out. I mean, he was, who knows, it could have saved a lot of lives, and it definitely would have saved a lot of lives, but who knows, maybe he would have murdered more people later if he was released at a later date and had more pent-up anger. We really can't just sit here and speculate, but I guess we can. So, apparently I wasn't the only one that was shocked by this. January said again, he's the district attorney, he's a poster child for parole reform. He should have never been let out of jail. I mean, he's right. He shot and killed a man, served half his sentence, and he's back out in society without any kind of, you know, repercussions. I mean, 7 years served is very lenient. So, Juan is technically a free man in 1994. He steps out of prison, back into his old life. So, over a year passes in Dallas County, and Juan is, he's around 27 years old at the time, and he's found work around town working as a painter. I'm guessing this is something that was easy for him to pick up in the surrounding area, or maybe he knew a friend that got him into it, or was it just a trade that was easily understandable for him? But found some work doing that, and I'm guessing that was sufficient enough, or wasn't making him enough money or paying the bills, because, well, he went back to doing what he always does, stealing cars. Again, I'm assuming he had some kind of connection from prison, or just that in general he knew where to sell these stolen vehicles, or maybe he just had ties to bad criminal people. I'm not sure. It just didn't work out for him. You know, the whole going back to work and becoming part of society, it just didn't work out for Juan. He just couldn't acclimate and become a normal functioning member of society, and he just went back to his old ways. So the date is July 1st, 1995. This is really strange to me, but Juan either knows a kid or befriended a kid that's about 15 years old at the time of the crime. And he has, it's almost like he's riding shotgun with him, like he's his buddy. It's almost like he's teaching him how to be bad, because to this kid, you know, this guy that's released from prison has been out for a year, might seem cool to him if he's, you know, in that kind of lifestyle, and maybe he wants to learn. That's the only thing that I could really assume from all of the quotes and tapes that I've listened to on the case, that he was kind of coerced into going along with him. Maybe it just started off as like, hey, you want to go to the gas station with me real quick? And this kid got dragged into a murder spree, which is insane once all the details unfold. So it's July 1st, 1995. I kind of remember the time and where I was in Arizona at the time as a young man. This is going on in Dallas. Juan Chavez and this kid that I mentioned named Hector Fernandez, I mentioned this, he was 15 years old. They steal a car from a Greyhound maintenance facility in Dallas. Like, these are chain-linked fences, you know what I mean, security and everything. I'm not sure. Probably in the mid-90s, it was probably a lot more lax, and there also wasn't any kind of video surveillance back then. So things like this were a lot easier to get away with. You could walk into a place, break into someone's car, hotwire it, and leave. There wasn't, like, GPS, there wasn't camera systems, there just nothing like we have today. So the two of them steal a car, I'm guessing from an employee that was parked there, and they drove off with it. And then the simple fact that no one was murdered that day tells you that there was no kind of conflict to get the car. Also, there was no reports of any kind of, like, assault charges or anything like that. It was like they snuck in, maybe they found a car that was unlocked, grabbed it, and went. Well, this was the vehicle that they would use to begin their crime spree. So Juan and Hector drove through the night into the wee hours of the morning, approximately around 12:55 a.m., about 1 a.m., they pull into a Dallas County apartment building with a couple of payphones near it. They kind of pull into one of the spots near the payphones. They're within walking distance of them. And Juan pulls the car up, stops, puts it in park. Takes a moment, sees that there's a man talking on the left payphone, and there's a woman talking on the right payphone. The man's name on the left, his name is Jose Morales, and unfortunately, he would soon become the first victim in a violent and senseless robbery and murder spree. So, this poor guy, Jose, is chatting on this payphone outside of this apartment complex, and back in the day, we didn't have cell phones. 1995, I mean, you had to be some kind of, like, big shot banker or a stock trade broker in New York to have a cell phone in your car or something like that, and they were a gigantic brick, and they were heavy, and they were expensive, and the bills were like $4,000 a month. So, realistically, if you were a normal person, you used a payphone or a landline. So payphones were pretty popular back in the day, so two people using one, using both of them at the same time was realistic. Also, it's a great place to find victims for robberies late at night. People are isolated, people are alone. A lot of the times there isn't like good lighting around these payphones, or at least the ones that I've seen that were around back in the day that I was, you know, a kid and was a teenager, didn't really seem like the safest places to go. So while Jose is sitting there, or standing there at least, talking on the payphone, minding his business, Juan exits the vehicle, and from reports, he acts as if he were waiting to use the payphone, or, you know, waiting in line almost. He approaches Jose and asks him in Spanish, "On the line?" And before Jose could answer, and this truly shows you what kind of brutal, psychopathic murderer with no empathy he was, he brandishes a black revolver, aims it at Juan's chest, and fires a volley of shots, striking him multiple times. The victim slumps over onto his stomach, writhing in agony, and Juan calmly walks over to him while he's on the ground, bleeding out from his chest, reaches into his back pocket, removes his wallet, and while this poor man is laying there dying, he fires another round into his upper back and kills him. Now the woman on the right payphone witnessed the murder. He didn't kill her. Her name was Yadira Ramirez. She stood there frozen in terror and watched everything unfold. She watched the vehicle flee with the two men inside. The saddest part about all of this was that the poor guy only had $2 in his wallet. I mean, shot three times. Killed in cold blood for $2. So, shot over $2. The pair then drive to a construction site in North Dallas, where they spot a lone security guard working named Susan Ferguson. This is a quote from January, the prosecutor. "He pulled up. She leans in the window, reciting some of the testimony. He starts acting like he wants directions, then pulls a gun and asks her if she has children. I mean, she's crying by then and says, yes, yes, and he shoots her anyway. Then he takes his car and runs over her head. This guy was unreal. Holy shit. He took a security guard. And I've read this story. She leans in the window. So she leans in. My God. He pulls this gun out and shoots the woman in the face. I mean, she's freaking. If she's not already dead, she's in shock. And to finish her off, he runs her head over and squashes it like a melon until it pops with the car. This guy is truly a psychopath. That shit was shocking for me to read. I've never read anything like that in my life. So, approximately 40 minutes later, Chavez shot another security guard. Now, this guy's name was Kevin Hancock, and he's one of the victims that actually didn't die. Now, he didn't walk away with no injuries. Kevin Hancock, he was in West Oak Cliff while working at his apartment complex on his shift. He was also a security guard, like I mentioned, and he was struck he sustained permanent paralysis. After they shot him, he sped off. 10 minutes later, Chavez and Fernandez went to East Oak Cliff. So they went from North Dallas to West Oak Cliff to East Oak Cliff. So they're literally just driving across town, north town, east, west, and they're just killing people with no motive, no objective. Just about 10 minutes later, they arrive in East Oak Cliff and the other side of town. They find three men standing by, you know, the side of the road with their car. And, I mean, it's unfortunate for them that their car is broken down on the side of the road, but Chavez pulls up to them and he shoots and kills Jesus Briceño. And now, while he's got the gun on the other men, he has Fernandez take the 9mm that they stole from the security guard, Kevin Hancock. He took his gun, and now the kid's got that gun. And under the orders of Chavez, using the 9mm, he orders him to shoot Francisco Jaime and Alberto Rivera. And he does that. He injures both of them. It should be noted he doesn't execute them. I think he didn't want to kill them, which further goes along with the narrative of this kid was dragged into this by a complete psychopath. And it doesn't say exactly where these men were shot, but it was non-life-threatening. They were treated, and they lived. So, I mean, you can imagine the police arriving on scene must have just thought, my God, what a mess. Some of these victims all over town, multiple gunshot victims dead, heads crushed in the streets, women, men. I mean, there's really, it's random almost how he's striking. So not long after that, police get another disturbing call. Two more victims are found. They arrive on scene to an even grislier scene than the first one I mentioned. So Alfonso Contreras and Maria Guadalupe, just a regular couple, girlfriend and boyfriend, sitting in their pickup truck in their apartment complex, when Juan approached the couple from the driver's side of the vehicle. So he comes up, and you don't necessarily see him if you're in the driver's seat. You're looking forward. Unless you're concentrating on that left rear, that left mirror, you don't necessarily see someone coming up in your peripheral there. So Juan comes up, revolver out, and he fires into the cab. Fires into the cab, hitting and killing Contreras instantly. Now that bullet that killed Contreras ricocheted and hit Maria Guadalupe. Now she's laying in the side of the truck, injured, still alive. And Juan gets into the truck with both of the victims in the truck. So we've got the dead Contreras slumped over in the middle. And then we have Maria Guadalupe Delgadillo in the far passenger seat, bleeding out. So Juan takes the truck, gets in it, starts driving with it. And Fernandez is following in the other stolen vehicle that they originally got from the Greyhound parking lot, basically right behind him. So the two drive along for a little further after, it's not sure exactly, it's not mentioned how far, Juan Chavez stops the truck, kicks out the dead Contreras, repositions the truck, and slowly rolls the vehicle over the head of Contreras, smashing his skull and leaving the contents of his head in the road. Both of the vehicles from that point were driven down to the Trinity River bottom. And that's where Juan Chavez took a dying Maria Delgadillo out of the truck, dragged her out of the car, and all the way down to this secluded area by the river bottom. And ordered Fernandez with his 9mm to shoot. But this time, he wanted her to be killed. He had Fernandez shoot her in the head, and he did. And at that point, I think anybody would have done what this man would have told you to say or do. Because he has a gun, you have a gun. You're 15 years old. You've seen him kill people for really nothing. I mean, what's from stopping him from killing you as well? So he kills the woman. He shoots her in the head. And then Chavez gets in his truck and starts to ride over her body multiple times. Smashing her head, smashing her chest, her body. He kind of just goes crazy on her. Police say the body was barely identifiable. He then drives the pickup truck to an exit off of Interstate 20, and he torches it. He burns it. Now there's three more men that die. So the initial conflict that started, these guys are at a tire shop, at like a used tire shop, whatever. When Chavez and Fernandez, and this time a third accomplice. So I'm guessing they burned the truck and then took that vehicle, found a third accomplice to go along with them, to kind of keep going on this spree. And they arrive at this tire shop. Looks like they want to do another robbery. There's a car that they're targeting that is inside the tire shop, but there's two men that are standing right in front, or I'm sorry, that are standing right in behind the vehicle, kind of blocking the entrance to the vehicle. So, you know, if I came up and I wanted to take this vehicle, I would have to go through these two men, quite literally. So they're kind of acting like tough guys, and, you know, Juan is a psychopath and isn't one to back down from a fight. So after a brief confrontation with them, some words were exchanged, they get back in the vehicle, and Juan smashes two of the men, the two that were standing behind the vehicle, with his own car, pinning them up against the vehicle. And He then takes his firearm and shoots and kills Antonio Banda. And again, I have to mention that the two men that were hit by the car were also run over multiple times, smashed, heads smashed, and killed, if they weren't already dead from the initial impact. So after this murder spree of 11 people, the police finally arrest both of them. They arrest Fernandez, they arrest Chavez, and they get them into the interview rooms. So police were able to have Fernandez flip and testify against Chavez for a reduced sentence of aggravated robbery. I mean, this kid shot two people, participated in robberies, was a witness to murder, and murdered a woman, they reduce his sentence to aggravated robbery. Which it's all murky. When you get to these points in the cases, it's you're letting go a small fish to catch a bigger fish. And police need these testimonies in order to get the if they're lacking any kind of factual evidence. But I feel like they had enough evidence to get Chavez and pin him for like multiple murders. They only try him for the payphone murder of Jose. That's the only murder that they pin him on, and it's enough to get him the death penalty. So one funny thing about his, what I mean, one thing that's funny about this case is the entire time when he was on trial, he kept referring to the media and telling them, "I still say I'm not guilty." Right before the judge read the sentence, Chavez literally blurted out, "I still say I'm not guilty." What kind of madman? And he was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. All of his subsequent appeals were denied, federal and state. I mean, they made the mistake once. They weren't going to make it again. I mean, this guy maintained his innocence till the very end. He became very solemn and religious in his last days, which, you know, cry me a river. You're not going to become the Pope in the last 2 weeks of your life because, yeah, you're going to be put on the death chair or the death, I'm sorry, the electric chair, or you're going to get the lethal injection. So, yeah, everyone's going to have their come to Jesus moment. And this was his. He refused a final meal. Interesting. I mean, if I was being put to death, I'm definitely taking that final meal. So it should be mentioned that Juan was fitted with a stun belt during the 90s just because he was such a violent offender during his trial. And this thing was set off during the second day that he was wearing it. He stood up literally in court and said, "I'm being electrocuted." And then he slumped over onto the table. He didn't sustain any injuries, but his attorneys did their best to dramatize it and make it into a big scene. Luckily, the judge didn't buy any of it. Juan was quoted as saying to the media, "I would like for you to tell all the victims and their loved ones that I am truly, truly sorry for taking their loved ones' lives. I am a different person now, but that does not change the fact of the bad things I have committed." He turned to the warden, he let him know that he was ready, and he closed his eyes. The serum flowed into the tubes, connected into his arms, and the lethal injection process had begun. After a few moments, Chavez opened his eyes, turned to the warden and said, "Is it working?" He closed his eyes for the last time and began to pray, muttering some kind of scripture. He was pronounced dead at 6:18 p.m. Wow. I mean, what can you say? What a terrible story. Tragic way for all these people to lose their lives. I mean, any murder is tragic. But senseless killing is just so much worse. I mean, he got what he deserved. Lethal injection is, I would have preferred the firing squad. That's honestly my opinion. He should have gotten what he gave. Just a brutal killer, just a psychopath. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to be profiled while he was on death row. Texas is one of the fastest states to move with the death row convictions. And I mean, they were famous in the 90s and the 2000s for convicting and killing people. He was the 34th person killed in Texas state history. And man, that guy was right when he said that the world would be a better place once he's gone. It's monsters like this that make you look over your shoulder or just, I don't know, just double check that there's not somebody You really never know when something like this is going to happen, but you can just do your best to stay vigilant and report any kind of suspicious activity you might see, even if it seems like it might be something trivial. It could be something that could break open a case for police that have been investigating something for months.
Wow. What a story. Brutal, brutal story. Guys, if you enjoyed this episode and you like what you heard, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform that you listen to, whether it's iTunes or Google Music or whatever. Also, if you'd like to support this podcast, you can also become a patron on my Patreon. That's patreon.com/premeditated. And there's two tiers. There's a $3 tier and a $7 tier. And you can check out all the details of what that offers. Pretty cool. Pretty fun. We're just getting started and we're hoping to keep growing. And they keep bringing you guys new episodes and new content. So thank you. And we will see you guys in just a couple weeks here with the new episode. Take care.